To go, and we'll be ready to start. So let me just roll through my video feeds and see who's there, because I can see your faces. Hey, Kay. You're still muted, Kay, so we can't hear you.
Yeah, no, there we go. Hello, Paul.
Lovely to speak with you.
Yeah, doing well, thank you.
Cool. Good to hear your voice and see your face this time. Normally, I don't get to see you.
No, very different.
Yeah. Hey, Leah and Luke, how you doing?
Hi, Paul.
How are you going?
Good to see both of you.
Yeah, we've got the kids out in the cubby house, so I've unmuted us, but let us know if the background noise picks up again. There was a lot of door slamming in the first session.
I love that. The kids out in the cubby house. That's not going to last, mate.
Oh, they slept there last night.
Oh, they slept there. Very cool. Yeah. Yeah. All right, maybe you'll never see them again.
Our job is done.
Yeah. Cool. And hi, Daniel. Hi, Rick. We won't talk to you. We'll talk to you later because we need to get underway. And hi, Angela. Great to have you guys with us. I'm going to start. So what's really good to talk about is the emotions that we go through and the change process, because that's what drives everything. So when it comes to emotions and change, then the first thing for us to understand is that as emotions go upwards, then intelligence goes down. And I'm sure you've had the situation where the pressure's gone up, you've got yourself to the point where you're losing it, and you say something that you wish later on you could take back, or that you'd never said, or you make some dumbass decision that you think, how on earth could I have ever come to that conclusion, or what the heck is going on, or whatever. So just let me see hands up if you have done that kind of a thing. You've made some kind of dumbass decision because the pressure was through the roof. Who's in that category? Hands up. Okay, I'm just beautiful, lots of you. So you know exactly what I'm talking about. Really, the thing that we need to understand is that what change does is it creates unpredictability. And this is a hilarious thing to talk about because nothing's predictable anyway. But we'll come back to that in a moment. But really what I'm saying is that as human beings, we are kind of like in the modern world, instead of wandering around in the forest, totally aware of what's going on, not knowing that we have to be ready for whatever could happen, otherwise we might be dead. In the modern era, what we do is we wander around feeling pretty safe. On many occasions, we should not feel safe. A lot of people drive their motor cars as if they're invincible. So, you know, there are distortions to that, but pretty much we feel pretty safe. And what happens is we develop a level of predictability that makes us comfortable. And we get comfortable with that because it's been around for a long time. And so you can be comfortable in your job, you can be comfortable with your partner, you can be comfortable with the place that you live, meaning the suburb or the city or the region or the country even. When things become unpredictable, we've got a problem, and that is that unpredictability leaves room for us to interpret what's going to happen in the future. And unpredictability leaving room for interpretation means that human nature can come in here and it can play a role in how we interpret what's going to take place. And that's why everybody sees change as a different thing. So people who are risk averse, they assume that there's going to be loss, that there's something going to, you know, vanish or be diminished or made small or whatever. The people who are pro-risk, you know, the bungee jumpers, well, they're just going, yeah, beauty, here's an adventure. Interesting enough, we all have a degree of both the risk-averse and the pro-risk within us. So, for example, you know, I'm probably in the pro-risk category. You know, someone who's spent 25 years flying hang gliders and ultralights is probably not the risk-averse kind of personality. Nevertheless, there are plenty of things that I'm risk-averse to. You know, when it comes to investing and all of those sort of things, I'm very much on the conservative side of things. But the reality is that most people, we talk about adventure. Most of us, if we could have adventure on our terms, would take it. So typically, you know, one of the things that we've found fun to do is go on holidays and have no plan. And when I talk to my friends or in groups like this about having no plan, people's faces light up with horror or disaster. So one of the things that Mary and I did a few years back was we went to Italy, and we in Milan we hired a motorbike, and we rode that motorbike around Italy for a couple of weeks. Pretty much most people are going to have a reaction that they can predict to that, and that is they either think that sounds like heaven on a stick or that sounds like a quick way to kill yourself. So let's have a look. Let's give me a response. So, Kay, what would your response be to jump on the back of the motorbike and ride around Italy for 2 weeks? What's your initial response, just off the top of your head?
Initial response to that is I'm open for that, but generally I'm very risk averse.
Uh-huh. Cool. But that one?
That one I'm okay with. Yep, I'm up for that. Holidays, up for any adventure.
Okay, now here's exactly what I was hoping to see, and most of you will have this. When the risk is within what you consider to be okay, bingo, you turn it into adventure. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely.
Let's see if we can find someone who would not jump on the motorbike. Is there anybody in that category where you'd go, no, bugger that for a joke, there's no way I'm going to be in that? Sounds like everyone's going to go for it.
We're all coming on your next trip, Curly.
Okay. Well, we've got a new version of it, and that is that, you know, our friends Bob and Carol, they won't come with us on the motorbike because Bob can't ride a bike and he thinks they're the most dangerous things in the world. So now we hire a van and we do exactly the same thing, and we just wander around some country, and pretty much when we get to some place, you know, basically we drive around. I do the driving because I will not let myself be in a car with any of those other people driving, with the exception of Julie. So I'm happy if Julie's driving, but Julie likes to be doing the what we call the Airbnb thing. So we're driving along in the van and the rest of them are on their laptops looking for an Airbnb in a nice place. And we go there and we stay there. And while we're there, we'll have our dinner and our drink and our whatever. And we'll figure out where do we go tomorrow if we're going to go somewhere. And we may go somewhere or we may not, and it might be a complete 180-degree change in direction or whatever. How many of you would be in that? Who would be drift around an unknown country in a van on the wrong side of the road?
I would be, Paul, for sure. But I was interested that you also highlighted your risk averse to somebody else driving.
Yes. Yes.
You're pro-risk in one part of the adventure and you're risk-adverse in the same adventure another section of it.
Exactly. So there I am driving around happy as, and if Bob's driving, I'm not even getting in the car. Right? In fact, when we get Carol and we don't let her sit in the middle at the back because that means she can see between the driver and the passenger in the front, and she screams and yells about all the traffic coming at her. So she has to sit in the back on one side or the other. Otherwise, for me, the trip's not worth it. In other words, in one set of circumstances, I find myself very risk-averse, and in another set, very pro-adventure. And what I'm going to suggest to you is, where is all of this taking place?
In your head.
Between my ears. So that's really the key here, is to understand that if it's happening between my ears, I can change it. I don't have to interpret Carol's ability to drive as less than zero, right? I can have other interpretations. I can create other interpretations of what might happen. So if you understand that that's all happening between my ears, then basically you'll see that what happens is people battle with each other based on the fact that they own the correct interpretation. That for some reason their interpretation of what's going to happen or may happen or likely to happen is the real one, and everybody else is a lunatic. And everybody else needs to change their mind and agree with them. And if they just did that, everything would be all right. That's where conflict comes about. Really, the conflict is between our ears. So when we talk about that, then really, if you look at it, what happens is logic goes out the window from the point of view of it was never really present anyway, because I've interpreted what's going to happen positively and Mary's interpreted as something that's going to happen that she's interpreted that as negative. In other words, we can come to the same conclusion about what's going to happen. For example, when Mary's mum was living with us before she died. She spent 25 years living with us before she died, and at the end she had dementia. And one day we looked out the window and there she was battling with the wet washing to take it out and hang it on the line, because she considered it her, rite of passage almost, to do the washing and the ironing. There was no requirement, of course, but, she wanted to do that, so she did. And we watched her one day hang everything up in the wind, and it was a real battle for her, and Mary was in tears about the battle. And, as soon as she got it all hung up, she'd forgotten that she'd just hung it up, so she started taking it down again and putting it in the washing basket to bring it back in. And, of course, that had Mary even more in tears. And we were both watching the same thing. And Mary's in tears about the needless effort, her mum's struggle and whatever. I said to Mary, there's another way to see this, and that is that Lou has something to do. She feels productive, she feels useful, and she actually likes to call the washing a mongrel and talk about the wind being a bastard. It actually gives her a heap of energy and something to fight with, and she really likes it. And what you'll see is that Mary and I are both looking at the same situation and interpreting it differently. Does that make sense to you guys? Okay. What we do is we then start to battle with each other about who's right. So Mary says, but it's not right that she should be doing that. I want to go out there and take the load off her. And I go, well, if you take the load off her, she's got nothing to do and she's going to sit around, reading a book and, doing nothing. And at least she's physically active and she loves being out there and she loves having something to fight with and blah, 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 blah. And neither of us have really got a solid foundation for what we're saying. We've got a strong opinion. And so what happens is we argue about it and logic goes out the window and it starts to be an argument about our view of the situation. In other words, it becomes an argument about whether Mary sees things negatively and I see things positively or not. In other words, the argument progresses on and it very quickly goes away from what Lou's doing with the washing and turns into how we see things. Does that make sense to you guys? It's now not about the washing or Lou. It's about our view of what's going on and whether it's good or bad. And we're arguing with each other about the position that we've taken rather than the situation we're observing. Does that make sense to you guys? Just nod or wave or say something. Okay, cool. All right. What happens then is that the situation pretty much goes down the toilet. And the reason it goes down the toilet is that there's no real ability for us to come together because we have this opposing view. And so I start talking about she's always been like that. She always sees things that way. She starts talking about you always see things your way. You never listen to me. You don't da 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 da. And we get into the always and the nevers, and it becomes an argument about character and personality and not a discussion about who should be doing the washing or whatever. So when you look at it, if we look at this and we bring it into change, then the reason that change sometimes is good and sometimes is bad is whether we see it to be threatening or not. So when change doesn't threaten us, then what happens is we just grab onto it. And the reason we do that is our equilibrium. I'm going to talk about this equilibrium concept a bit. What I mean by equilibrium is you kind of fit within your world and everything's all right and your world is not disturbed and everything's kind of feeling okay. In other words, it's kind of like, there's no big dramas. There's a few things you'd like changed or sorted out, but they'll kind of get their own way. So equilibrium is kind of like different for all of us, but it has a definite kind of sense of permanence around it and that things are okay. So what happens when change turns up that it doesn't upset our equilibrium, we just go for it. And I think smartphones are probably a really easy, simple example. As soon as you can see, and I mentioned this before the break, as soon as we can see that the phone or the device really is going to save us time or money and make life more convenient, then the change is not threatening. The change is actually the opposite of threatening. And yet when you think about it, if we take the current circumstances away, the single largest change in our life over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years hasn't actually been like the internet. The internet sort of has facilitated the ability to walk around with a mobile device, the mobile phone, allowing us to bank and email and message and all of that sort of stuff. So we live a life that is totally different to the one that we lived 20 years ago, and yet we embraced it. We didn't. There was no real resistance. There were people saying, oh, those bloody phones, you know, the radiation's going to make you go crazy. There was an odd, predictable number of people who were saying this is bad, and there's the odd number of people. There will always be a small group who actually like things the way they were and continue with them. So, for example, most of you probably get your music fed straight to your device and into your ears. Would that be true? Most of you get your music directly downloaded. Would that be true? Yep. Okay. Are you aware that there are some people who've got highly specialised turntables and a collection of black vinyl discs, the old LP records, and they keep them and they have parties and they get together where on their old analog equipment, they play their music and they really enjoy that process. They say it sounds better. It certainly sounds different. They're saying different is better. But how many of you are aware that there are people who just get into the old version because they like it? Now, that could be, we could be talking about there are people who drive old cars. There are people who play music on turntables. There are people who go to, have any of you heard of the Society for Creative Anachronisms, whatever that makes? It's the people who get dressed up in armour and go jousting and wear medieval clothing and have big feasts and that kind of stuff. In other words, we say things, we say we move on, and the easy thing is digital music and, you know, ebooks and all that sort of stuff. But there are people who still would rather pick up a book and read the book, turn the pages themselves, than get an audio book or even get a digital book. Is that, you're aware that the small number doesn't really make any difference? Just nod or wave or something like that? Okay, cool. Basically, the thing we've got to look at is what happens when our equilibrium gets disturbed. In other words, things are fine if we can have them how we want them. But when uncertainty increases, then our equilibrium gets disturbed and we're not okay with that. And we're not okay with that because we just can't predict what's going to go on. That is a very unpleasant feeling. And that unpleasant feeling, what happens is we get motivated to make that unpleasant feeling go away. So we'll go out of our way to suppress the unpleasant feeling. We'll be compelled, we'll become compulsive. So at any time that you are compulsive or find yourself compulsive, the chances are there's a bunch of ugly feelings propelling that. And whether that's a feeling, whether that's anger, sadness, fear, shame, guilt, actually doesn't matter. But when there's a feeling that you're uncomfortable with, for example, my friend Bob is uncomfortable with sitting still. He hates to be inactive. Very, very difficult to get him to watch a TV show or a movie or anything like that. He's recently been through a cancer episode. He had chemotherapy, radiotherapy. He's had a couple of weeks at home and he hates sitting around. As a consequence of that, his boat is spotless. Like, his boat looks like they built it yesterday because he's been polishing the fuck out of it. My house, which I don't live in at the moment because I'm down at the farm. Julie's at our house up in Calypso Bay. Our house has got, the barbecue's had the life polished out of it. The front balcony's been gurneyed to the point where the tiles are nearly coming off. The garden's had the weeds ripped out of it. And Bob is exhausted physically at the end of every day because he doesn't like being with himself. He's uncomfortable to just sit in his own company. He gets so uncomfortable, he has to get up and do something. And it gets that ridiculous that he will, you know, like, Julie might find a photo and put it up for you later, but at the back of the villas where we live, there's a car park, and that's owned by the community. And Bob's been out there and he's gurneyed the whole car park for our four villas, and that's an area maybe about 1,000 square metres. He's gurneyed the whole thing. But then he's gone into the public park and he's gone into the first three parking spaces so that's for people who visit us, they can park in a clean spot. In other words, you've got to be desperate when you're gurneying a car park that doesn't belong to you, but he's saying, well, it does belong to us because people come to visit. Well, the consequences of that is you've got clean concrete, and then you've got concrete that's very dark grey because it's probably 18 years old, and so it's got 18 years worth of grime and dirt and whatever ground into the concrete, and then there's this line, apparent line in the middle of nowhere where it goes to clean because he can't sit with himself. So that's what I mean by we will do the thing that we need to suppress it. He finds that he's compulsive like that. We're used to it, and so we just let him do it. And so that means that, you know, every now and then my shed gets totally rearranged. Everything gets taken out of the shed and all gets put back in. And he's very like my mother-in-law, Lou. He whinges and moans and bitches and complains the whole time about Curly being a useless bastard and he never organises things properly. And when is he going to get his shit together and do this shed properly? This is the third time I've done Curly's shed in the last 12 months. That's true. It's the third time he's done my shed in the last 12 months because I just throw shit in there because I realise the time's going to come when Bob needs something to do. And if my shed's too neat, well, he's out of things to do.
So, I haven't told you yet today, Dad, but he was back from Bunnings at 6:30 this morning and he's replaced all the rollers on all the sliding doors for all of the villas.
Yeah, staggering concept, you know. The doors were working fine, but now they work better. So, and of course, what part of being active like that is he stands back and goes, look at that. And he just goes, look at that. That's amazing. You know, when he owned a farm, he bought a mower that cost about $140,000 because the farm was big and he needed a big lawnmower, and every day after work he'd come home and he'd mow the lawn. The place looked like a golf course. It was just a farm. It looked like a golf course. And every afternoon he'd get off after an hour or an hour and a half on the mower, which, like, if you think about it, that's just like the worst thing in the world is mowing grass. And so he would get off and go, look at that. And it was kind of like, you know, there's something, you can see what you've done and all that kind of thing. But basically, he was suppressing unpleasant feelings. Compulsive about it. The real question for you is, what are you compulsive about? Because it's very important that you understand where your compulsions are. Otherwise, your compulsions will run you and you won't even know. Because when we go to Bob and say, yeah, look, mate, you're just cleaning for the sake of cleaning, he goes, but it needs doing. In other words, he's got a massive justification for it, and that allows him to keep going, which means that he doesn't have to change his behavior, which of course would be very good for him to do, but, you know, hasn't got around to doing that yet. 72 years old, unlikely to at this point. So we go out of our way to suppress the ugly feeling. That's all fine, but what happens is that if change continues to increase, and I'm going to suggest to you that it is increasing, that the rate of change is actually going up, then what happens is this, you know, and I've deliberately got the emotions up and the intelligence down, arrows there. Then what happens is we tip out of responding and we go into reaction. And you're going to be at your worst when you're in reaction. Reaction simply means, the way that I mean it here, simply means that you are doing something compulsively without thinking it through. And, you know, you get a stimulus and the reaction is instant. So make a list of your compulsions. I notice lots of you are writing, so some of you can tell me what you're writing down. What do you do? How many of you work? Just wave if you work. Bunch of workers. Gary's slicing his throat. I hope you guys can see each other. Okay, so reaction
no
is...
No work, really.
What was that, mate?
No work.
No work.
Light.
That broke up a bit. Just say it again.
That means no work. Not slicing.
Means no work. Yep. Cool. But you're pretty active, aren't you?
Yes, very.
Yep. Yep. What kind of active?
I'm running 11 Zoom classes for the karate school. Surfing, yep, every morning.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Renoing the house.
Uh-huh. Cool. And doing a bit of coaching as well.
Yes.
Cool.
You've still got five active.
So that last bit again?
I've still got five active ones, even though it's all a bit up and down at the moment.
Yep. Cool. Right, so that keeps you busy, keeps you working on it, you know, gives you plenty to do, because as human beings, we need purpose. We need to be getting on with stuff. So not a bad effort for a guy down in Marimbula just doing his thing. The thing for us to understand that happens with going into reaction is as your reactivity increases, then what happens is you use decreasing rationale. In other words, reactivity creates non-logical processes, which you will find easy to justify and easy to kind of explain away. So the more reactive, the less sensible, the less planned, the less useful. So let me show you a graph that I think most of you will relate to quite easily. What happens is we travel through life and pretty much everything goes okay until we get uncomfortable. So let me graph for you a couple of things. So as change increases, then we go into the red and then the orange level. But let me graph just this. The green line there is meant to represent the rate of change that we're experiencing over the last 50 to 100 years. You could put yourself anywhere on that line. But how many of you understand it's parabolic or J-shaped in nature in as much as change is actually accelerating? Just wave or say something if you understand change is accelerating. Okay, that's cool. So change is accelerating. But if we look at how we would like change to be, it's going to be like the red line. And what I mean by that is we can handle change as long as it's not too quick. When they came to me and they said, we're going to change you from woodwork teacher to maths teacher, well, it wasn't changing me from woodwork teacher to dentist, right? So the level of change wasn't that great. So we can handle change as long as it doesn't come at us too quickly. So if you look at where the green and the red line intersect, then what happens as soon as change gets faster than we like it, in other words, the red line is a purely personal line. Some people like that red line to be a lot steeper than I've drawn it. Some people like it to be a lot flatter than I've drawn it. So the red line is purely personal opinion. The green line is just kind of some kind of representation of the fact that we live in rapidly changing times, probably time of the most technological advance in the history of mankind. And so at some point, we're all going to get uncomfortable. So what happens is we get uncomfortable whilst the change accelerates, but then it keeps going and then we get into confusion, which is what am I supposed to do? And then we see anxiety and resistance and eventually irrational fear and pushing back against it. This is actually a different version of the change curve that I showed you before the break. It's important to realize that this is important because you and the people around you are stuck on this time thing. And in my opinion, we are well into the area where the green line's gone above the red line. For those of you who has a business dealing with other people, and that looks like most of you, then what you've got to realize is a lot of people are resisting this. A lot of people are, well, I'm going to suggest to you, we are well into the red zone. We may even be into the orange zone right towards the end there. But as a race, as a community, as a country, we're at the point where the green line is way above the red line and most people are just out of their depth as far as comfort is concerned. And so you're going to see lots of anxiety, lots of resistance, lots of irrational fear, lots of dumbass things, lots of decisions that are non-logical, those kind of things. If you are making sales in your field, some of you do that every day, this is a handy graph to refer to because if I was making sales, I would be saying to my prospects and my clients, the people that I was wanting to convince that they needed me as a coach, for example, or, you know, Angela, you know, might be talking to, they need to get involved in an ongoing program rather than one visit to the physio. I would be showing this red and green line with the rectangle and saying and asking people, at what point do you get discomfort? And at what point do you realize you'll need help? Because without help, what's going to happen is it's all going to go haywire. That would be my approach to convincing somebody that they need us on board to help them cope with what they are going through or what their people are going through. For everybody that you work with, I would draw this graph and just say, where do you feel like you are? Because some people are going to say, I'm where the lines are crossing. Some people are going to, can you guys see my cursor? Yep. Some people are going to say they're here. Some people are going to say they're back here on the left. some people are very comfortable with the amount of changes going on at the moment, looking at it and going, hallelujah, at last we can get computers to do stuff that we don't want to do ourselves. Some people are already way up here. So for me, a lot of conversations about where people are at would involve this graph. Whether you put the colours in the words doesn't really matter, because when you ask somebody to indicate where they are, that's their opinion and that's the only thing that counts as far as they're concerned. So if you understand that, then you'll understand lots of people are basically out on a wire, not knowing what to do. Essentially, I'm summarising that by saying, if you get ahead of the change curve, if you get comfortable with the change curve, then you are the change person and you have the capacity to change others, because you'll be able to be cool, calm and collected about the circumstances rather than understanding the panic and the desire to make things change. This thing gets to be really important from the following point of view. The thing about change is it brings up the fear of the unknown. I talked about that before the break. The fear of the unknown is a made-up thing. So there are two things for us to be aware of, and I'm going to get you to make your own notes about this. Fear of the unknown has two words in it that we have to address separately. The first one is fear, and the second is unknown. Now, it's only a four-word expression, fear of the unknown. So fear, you have to go into the future to be scared. So the thing for us to understand is there is no need to be scared, because if you come into the present, that's where your point of power is. So for you to affect anything, you have to be in the present moment. Going into fear is going to blow all your energy and distract you and cause you to not come up with positive solutions. So when you experience fear, or you're with someone who's experiencing fear, your job is to get back into the present, or get them back into the present. Does anybody need me to explore that anymore?
Kelly, I've just got a quick question.
Yeah, mate.
Mum's having really bad panic attacks at the moment with her eyes failing, and I have been speaking to her about the fear factor, and it's in this, in those brackets, exactly what we're talking about now. I'm just trying to get a handle on how to get her in out of that hole.
I think the way you get people out of holes is you take them further into the hole.
Yeah.
So a common fear is, what if we go broke? I know I'm not talking about your mum at the moment, but, you know.
No, that's fine.
Fears are like, what if? So most fears start with what if. You know, your mum's going to be, but what if I bump in the coffee table and fall over and hurt myself? What's it going to be like having coffee with people I can't see? You know, maybe I won't be able to hear them. That's the next thing. Basically, fear is imagination. What we're doing with fear is we're using our imagination to terrorize ourselves. It's a critically important thing for you as a practitioner to understand. When I say practitioner, as a person interested in your personal growth, The mechanism for fear is worth understanding. And the mechanism for fear is, I'm going to use my imagination to terrorize myself. You could use your imagination to do the opposite. And a good example is, do you want to jump in a van and drive around Italy not knowing where you're going? What we're doing is we're using our imagination. Well, you tell me, what were you imagining just then? When I said, let's jump in a van and drive around Italy, Bronwyn, what were you imagining, mate?
Oh, I was imagining the scenery.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Did you say greenery? Or the scenery?
Scenery.
Okay, cool. Take it one step further, because you were visualising the scenery, but you were actually imagining a feeling.
Probably just peace or joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. If somebody else is driving and somebody else is finding the accommodation, I'm relaxed.
Cool. So what's going on there is we say a visual, but we actually mean a feeling.
Yep.
And so whatever feeling you had, you know, some people, when I say, oh, we jumped on the motorbike and whatever, some people just imagine a terrible car smash and us at the bottom of it. So it's the imagination used to do what? Well, to either terrify yourself or to pacify yourself or to have a great feeling or whatever it is. What I'm going to suggest is that what we imagine is what we've been trained to imagine, but we've been trained to imagine a disaster because we have to make sure it's not fatal. And that's why all fears are actually fears of death. Like I said, the three main fears are fears of intensity, fears of nothingness, and fear of the unknown. And it's the unknown that is the most closely related to the fear of death. So we want to make sure that we're not going to get taken out. And for Gary's mum, it's pretty much going to revolve around, you know, will I survive? If I'm blind, will I actually survive, or am I going to take myself out? Or is life going to be worth living, or whatever it is she's imagining? I think the trick, and now I'm specifically talking to you, Gary, about your mum, I think the trick is that you say, okay, so what will be different? When and if you go blind, if this continues and you do go blind, I mean, what's your mum? She's 82 or 83 or something like that?
She was 89 last week.
Okay, so pushing 90. So then, you know, she's probably imagining some horrible end. So I'll be asking her what she imagines. And if it's things like, well, I'm going to walk into the coffee table, I'm going to fall over and break my neck, then I'll be asking, okay, what then?
Yeah, she just feels the world's closing in on her.
Yeah.
In the darkness, and she's just about death, so two things at once.
Yes. So the what I'd be wanting to turn her to is, well, what other possibilities other than the ones you're imagining?
Yeah, I give her the visual of having the grandchildren on her knee, which brings her joy, and that brings her out, but she slides quickly.
Yeah, because it's kind of like I can imagine something good for a short period of time, and then the negative one comes back because the negative one is there to stop me from getting killed.
Yeah.
So that's simply a matter, not simply a matter, it's nothing simple. It's a matter for us, if I turn this general, it's a matter of us turning our imagination to what's the real possibility. So I want to tell you a couple of quick stories. I was listening to an audio book yesterday. I was doing some painting, right? Painting the side of the house. It's an ideal place for an audio book because I find painting boring as batshit. So I'm listening to the audio book and the guy's talking about Thomas Edison. He's one night, someone knocks on his door in a panic and says, your factory's burning down. And Edison gets all the family together and he's all very excited. And he says, come and watch this. You've all got to come and watch this. The joint's going to go up and you're going to see all these yellow and green flames and blue flames that you'll never see before, because that factory's full of weird ass chemicals that burn strange colors and you've never seen anything like it in your life. And so his major activity was getting his family together to see this pyrotechnical, some people would call it disaster, but he was saying it was a bit of scenery like you'd never seen in your entire life. That night, him and his investors lost approximately $1 million in cash, which I don't know what that would be worth nowadays. When interviewed about it, because he was quite famous at the time, when interviewed about it, he said, we haven't lost anything except a pile of old junk we couldn't make work. There's nothing in that factory that was actually an invention, because we still haven't invented the light bulb and all the things that we're working on inventing. So none of our inventions have actually worked yet. So we haven't lost anything because there's nothing in there that's actually working. The building was uninsured because it was built out of some special concrete that was supposed to be fireproof. Turned out it wasn't, and so the whole joint went up. So the next year, him and his investors made approximately $10 million. And once again, who knows what that's worth in today's money? But the reality is, when we look at it, most people are going to look at a factory fire, particularly if they own the factory, they're going to look at that as one of the greatest disasters they've ever personally experienced. But he's saying, hey, watch this. We're going to see like pyrotechnics like we've never seen before, and it'll show us a new way to be getting on with it. And I think that that's the difference in imagination used positively and negatively. So he said, we're going to start fresh and we're going to be going better. We'll be able to do a whole lot of things we were not able to do before because we're not held back by all the garbage that we're trying to make work. In other words, he didn't know what the future held. What he was saying, what he was doing was he's voicing his opinion about the future, about what he's going to do with it. And I'm going to suggest to you that, remember I said we've got two words to deal with. The first one is fear. Fear is imagination used to terrorize yourself. The solution is to use imagination to do the opposite of terrify yourself. And so with Gary's mum, it's a matter of focusing on how much she can get the opposite of being terrified. Now, obviously, as she feels the world closing in on her, that's going to be an ugly thing. But there are plenty of people in the world who've gone blind and gone on to do amazing things. So what is it that's great that can come out of that? Now, it might be that she develops a connection with the grandchildren that is much deeper because she can't see them or hear them. It may be a very unusual, very different kind of relationship. She needs to kind of look at, well, Gary, what you need to focus on is helping your mum to see what could be enhanced, what could be better, what could be greater because of this. Because fear, like I said, is going into the future. The thing that's making her go blind might stop. So let's worry about when it happens. Or while you can see, Mum, let's get everything in your house and bolt it in position and put things, you know, put soft surfaces on, you know, where we need them so that, and let's have you get around the house with your eyes closed so that you can figure out where the coffee table is and blah, 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 blah. It could be all sorts of things that turn into structure and moving forward as opposed to just being terrified. Make sense? Cool. Okay, the second word we need to look at in that expression, the first one is fear. And what I'm suggesting is there are times to be scared, but they're when things are happening, not when you're anticipating things happening. So the second word, so whenever you're afraid, what you need to do is step into it. You need to ask yourself, what is the story I'm telling myself and how likely is that story? The chances are you're telling yourself a story that's highly unlikely because we tend to imagine the worst. The second thing is if I'm telling myself a story that terrifies me, well, what are the strategies to handle that? Many of you heard me talk about someone saying to me, what if we go broke? I think it was Mary at one point. We were broke when we were 40-odd. Seems like a long time ago as I head towards 70, but around at age 40, we'd moved into the caravan. We're living there, no water, no electricity for 18 months. Felt like broke. We weren't actually broke, but it felt like it. In response to going broke, I said, okay, if we actually have nothing, if we get reduced to zero and everything is taken away, what would we do? And so I said, well, I would ring up my closest friend and say, can I come and live at your place for 6 weeks? I want to use your internet. I want to eat your food, drive your car, use your electricity, and I want to be there for 6 weeks. And that was Bob, and I rang him and I said, this is just a hypothetical. What would happen? How would we go if I asked? And he said, when can you turn up? He wasn't thinking about the future. He wanted that to happen straight away. So I rang the next one, and basically worked out that Mayors and I, in 6 week periods, would go about 14 months before we needed to, you know, have figured out our own accommodation. And surely we could go back around again, you know. So there were a lot of people who'd have us for 6 weeks and whatever. In other words, what I did was I dived into the problem and not away from it. I said, okay, let's imagine we do go broke. Let's imagine we do have nothing. What would we do then? is what I found really useful for the people in the bushfires in Canberra in 2003. When they were reduced to zero, then, you know, and there are a lot of people who said, look, we own this block of land. It used to have a house on it, but the house is burnt to the ground. Now we own a block of land that's worth 400 grand, but we owe 600 and we have no insurance. I go, okay, that's a fairly good impersonation of being reduced to zero financially. Let's take stock, and you know, you're still alive, you've still got your health, you know, you've still got each other. But when it comes to this, what do you do now? And the people who said, okay, what do we do now, were the people who got themselves out of it. They were the people who were able to take the circumstances and turn them into magic. So it's really a question of, okay, it might be what we're facing right now is an absolute unmitigated disaster. I don't think Gary's mum's ever going to say being nearly deaf and nearly blind is ever a good thing. But what do we do now? What strategy we do now? It's not until we focus on what can I do, what power can I bring to this, that we actually start to influence the circumstances. It's not until we ask the question, okay, what's next? What do I do now? That we move ourselves into the future. So the first word in that sentence was fear. Fear of the unknown. The last word, unknown. Many people are terrified of the unknown because what they don't do is face the facts that we can't know. So it only takes the slightest look at your world to understand that your imaginings about knowing what's going to go on in the future are nothing more than imagining. And basically they're used as medication to calm you down. We cannot know what's going to happen tomorrow. I can fairly safely say to you that I predict that Mary's still going to be my wife tomorrow. What I cannot do is predict whether she'll be alive or not. So, you know, she can get hit by a bus, she could suffer from a stroke, she could vanish overnight tomorrow. So the reality is we do not know what's happening next. That terrifies us because we can't get prepared for it. What I'm going to suggest to you is a change of attitude allows you to prepare for it. When you start saying to yourself, it doesn't matter what happened, I will develop a way to handle it. In other words, I will find the resources, whether they are within me or whether they are around me, I will find a way to do it. Then the fear of the unknown goes away, because the reality is none of us know anyway. So it's another situation where we're using imagination to calm ourselves, in this case, to calm ourselves down. You can't even say the pyramids are going to be there in another few thousand years. Eventually they'll be reduced to dust. So there's nothing predictable. However, most people don't like that. So the question you've got to ask yourself is this one. But let me, before we go to the next question, are you guys cool with those two words? Fear is imagination, unknown is imagination. Fear is imagination used to terrify you, unknown is imagination used to terrify you. You can use both of them. Turn it into whatever emotion you want, and you will then experience that emotion, and you will take action according to those emotions. And if the fear is big enough, you'll freeze in terror. And if the realization, well, I'll just cope, is big enough, then you'll relax. And those emotions will determine your experience, not the facts of the situation, because we don't even know that the facts are real, because what's a fact now is probably going to change over a period of time. So far, so good. Therefore, the question you've got to ask yourself is life trying to look after me? Is God or the universe trying to take care of me? Now, if you look at your life, there's only one conclusion you can come to. What is that conclusion?
I'm being well taken care of.
I've been well taken care of. So far, so good.
Yep.
But did you say, Leah? I can't hear you, mate. You're still muted. See, let me see if I can unmute you.
Sorry, the space bar wasn't working for some reason. Yeah, no, I was thinking it's exactly, I get exactly what I need. It might not always be what I want, but it's exactly what I need.
Okay, cool. Let's hear from somebody else. I'm interested in this question. Is God or the universe trying to look after you?
Life is sensational.
Well, I would agree with you, mate. I would say life beats the alternative.
Living, being alive and well. Yep.
Yep. Okay.
I take it back to pure existence. If I'm here, it makes little sense for me to be here for something horrible to happen, because that would be pretty twisted, right? And I don't believe that the universe is that twisted. So stands to reason, if I'm here, it can't be bad.
Yes. If you're here and you're breathing, something right is going on.
Yeah.
Cool. I get it. All right. Now, if that's the case, if God or the universe is trying to look after you, what's going to happen next is going to be whatever's right for you. You're just going to whinge and bitch and moan and complain if it's not what you were planning on. Many of the things that happen to you are shit at the time and turn out to be absolutely fantastic. So how many of you can recall something that was the worst thing that ever happened to you when it happened, but it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to you? Like, namely, you got married to someone and then you got divorced from them. And that might be the best thing that ever happened and then the worst thing that ever happened, or the other way around, or whatever it is. Make sense? Therefore, if I don't know what's happening, it's just my ego that needs to know. It's just my ego carrying on, telling me that I can't calm down until I figure out what it is. Rather than me saying, well, I've been looked after so far, so something that I don't yet understand, something that I don't yet comprehend is in the works, and it's going to make me a better person. I may have to struggle. I may have to teach myself things that I never expected to learn. I may have to go through things that are really, really difficult. But as a consequence of that, and when I look back at the rest of my life, everything that I've been through has made me a better person. Does that make sense? Everybody on board with that? What does that mean about change?
Change is good.
Change is good.
Inevitable and necessary.
It's inevitable. It's necessary. If you're going to get where you want to get, if you're going to go where you want to go, change is fundamentally important. Things must change.
Embraceable, Paul.
Say again, mate.
Embraceable.
Well, it's embraceable, and what we should do is embrace it.
Paul, when you're saying then it's just your ego carrying on, and would you be then saying ego is just that, like the fear rising up again? So yes. It's almost like a circle.
Yes, it's just the fear coming back.
Yeah, but when you did the thing on the spiritual laws or such, that's crossing across that thing. So you're moving sort of almost from flesh to spirit, like, you know, the universe has actually got me covered.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're sitting in ego, we're sitting in flesh, we're not sitting in the, you know, I'll call it the spirit realm of, hey, I'm being looked after.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is, it doesn't feel like we're being looked after because it doesn't fit with what our ego told us we wanted.
Okay.
Because our ego told us, you know, if I just had a couple of million extra, well, it'd all be, you know, that things would be sorted. And the universe says, well, instead of giving you the couple of million, what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you into oblivion where you have to figure out how to make that money yourself, and then you're cool because you've got that skill for the rest of your life.
Mm. Yep.
It's like we hope that our children don't get bullied. I would hope that they did, because, you know, especially when they're younger and they live with you, because that's when you're there to help them grow through the bullying and become bigger than the bullying.
Hmm.
So if they don't grow through the bullying and find their own inner strength because of the bullying, or because we somehow or other were able to stop the bullying, then that child doesn't experience a growth. They don't find the strength within themselves that they needed to find to become a person that we know that they could be. It's a little bit like that. There's a book called Let Them Eat Dirt, and it talks about parenting And what happens with parents is that with the first child, when the dummy falls out of their mouth, they grab the dummy and they boil the jug and they pour boiling water over the dummy and then they give it back to the child. And then with the second child, they pick the dummy up and they lick it and then put it in the child's mouth. And with the third child, they just pick the dummy up and stick it back in the kid's mouth. The reality is that some of the best vaccines known to man, the best thing that you can have is a dog in the house that your children live in, because when the kid kisses the dog, they pick up all the antibodies that they need to pick up to deal with, you know, the dog passing on stuff that ain't good for them and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So we don't like it, but we become strengthened through our struggle. We don't become strengthened through things that go easy for us. And so it doesn't actually matter which level you pitch it at, because, you know, if you've got a course and you've got to study it, and you're not, like, I know Jules has taught herself how to do Facebook backwards, right? It's really difficult stuff to learn. But it's sharpened her up in so many other areas that it's difficult to kind of make a list of how much more intelligent. It's like her brain grew. It's like she's a smarter person than she used to be. Not because of the Facebook stuff she knows, because, you know, that just gets applied, but because of the broadening of her aspect, the strengthening of her reasoning process and logic and analysis and all those sort of things, just way better at it than if she didn't have to learn that stuff, which, of course, you know, I managed to avoid because I said, that shit's too complicated, you learn it, which means that my brain didn't get to expand. And, you know, I'm looking at where we invest our money. So I'm saying we get a longer return off tools. But generally speaking, anything that you have to struggle with is going to strengthen you, but none of us would choose a struggle. Mm. None of us would look at that and go, yeah, give me, you know, like my relationship with Mary is when we ended up in the caravan, no water, no electricity for 18 months, we'd already been together for probably, I don't know, 20 years or so is a rough number. Our relationship, we'd probably 15 to 20 years we'd been married. But I can tell you that under the difficulty of that set of circumstances, our relationship went through the roof. And part of that is that I know that Mary would live with me in a tent. And part of the reason I know that she would live with me in a tent is she did. So I don't think I ever would have stuck my hand up and said, just give me that level of difficulty. Just give me the, you know, like bloody winter, starting a fire so you can cook your dinner. It ain't much fun. It might look like fun if you go camping, but that's because you chose to go camping. You know, when you end up in a set of circumstances where you think, you know, I felt like the biggest failure I'd ever met, all those sort of things. But the relationship went to the next level. What would I give for that relationship? Everything. You could take away everything I own, and I couldn't care less as long as Mary was left. So the reality is I got the greatest gift life could give by going through something that I would not want to have gone through. What we need to do is need to approach life from that perspective. This is shit. I don't like it. I don't want it to be like this. How do I change it more like how I want it? How do I take charge of the circumstances and how do I turn it? How do I become the person who can get out of this and into what it is that I want? There are a bunch of skills around that are really important for you to understand. I love this quote from Henry Ford. He said, if I'd have asked people what they wanted, they'd have said they wanted a faster horse. I'm going to suggest to you that the way to go is to understand that we were all taught that your intellectual quotient was the kind of the measure by which you were going to progress in life. You know, how smart you were was the thing that mattered. As it turns out, that just turned out to be able to measure who could remember piles of meaningless shit. It wasn't too long after that emotional intelligence turned up. And that was, how can you use your thinking processes to affect your emotional processes to get a better result? That's become the only known predictor of future success. If you go to IQ, how long would it take you to find some intellectual genius who's broke or who's been through one disastrous relationship after another? Basically, they're a dime a dozen. So intellectual Are you claiming the intellectual genius or the millions of results? Either one. So emotional intelligence gets us the results that we want. But what I'm going to suggest to you is that there's a new truth, and that is your adaptability quotient, your ability to change and adapt, your ability to be not like the dinosaur, your ability to go, things have changed, well, I've got to change along with them. I believe that this is the new unmeasured intelligence. And it's critically important that you develop your skills in that. It's simply a matter of saying to yourself, change is inevitable. We've seen the graph. We've seen that it's actually accelerating. Resistance is predictable. People are going to resist that change no matter how good it is for them. There's still going to be that level of resistance. But you know what's sensible? Expecting change, expecting it to happen. That's actually the sensible thing to do. Therefore, if we look at developing your adaptability quotient, I think it is directly proportional to your ability to let go of exist without feeling loss. In other words, to say the old normal is just exactly that, good riddance to it. There was a lot of lovely things about it, but we've got a new reality to replace, and we're going to experience joy and happiness and excitement about the adventure rather than the loss of what was there. I also think that is directly related to your willingness to embrace possible failure as measured by us human beings, because one of the things I've been saying to you is what we consider to be failure quite often turns out to be success. And I'll quote the living in the caravan example as one of those kind of things. By any measure, I would have called that failure until I realized what I got out of it. By any measure, Bob would say that the disappearance of his $50 million business a year, I want you to imagine $1 million a week and ask yourself what you could do with that, and then ask yourself what it would feel like to have that go up in smoke. And of course, when he did the exercise, he was able to turn from loss and grief to embracing the future in inside a couple of hours. So that's related to your ability to embrace failure as a step in progress, as a step in future success. In other words, fail fast, fail often, fail as quickly as you can, and get to the point where you've failed your way to success. Also believe that your adaptability quotient is directly proportional to your understanding that permanence means petrified. You know, our parents celebrated like crazy when I was made a high school teacher because they thought I had a job for life. It was permanent. For me, they might as well have petrified me and stuck a statue there because, you know, for me, it was a kiss of death. I enjoyed it the first few years, but then it kind of just became terrible. So permanence means petrified, unchanging, unable to be developed, unable to be turned into something new and exotic and powerful and wonderful and better than the next thing. I also believe your adaptability quotient is directly proportional to your ability to stay calm in the face of unpredictability. That's really the story that Gary needs to take to his mum. Is that if he can bring his peace and calmness and imbue that into his mum by reassuring her that she's going to be okay, that's probably the key message. Telling her how calm she's going to be okay is probably just a reason for argument. You know, she's probably going to have good arguments why she's not going to be okay. But that calm, cool reassurance is going to be all right. That she's still going to be loved. She's still going to be cared for. There's still going to be connection. She's still going to be able to feel people giving her a hug and a cuddle and, you know, feel the grandkids climbing all over her. That bring that calmness is actually, in the face of the unpredictability, that's the key message. That's the thing that's important. And I believe that, you know, it's critical to your well-being. I also reckon that your adaptability quotient is directly proportional to your ability to stay in the moment. It's staying in the moment that allows you to bring power to the situation instead of skipping into the future. You can skip into the future and imagine what you're going to invent, but don't skip into the future and imagine the disasters because, you know, you don't need to see them before they're coming. You know, you need to be able to be yourself and be at your best when it happens. If we talk about the skills for that, I realise I'm a couple of minutes over time, but we will wrap up in the next couple of minutes. Pretty much the skills for change boil down to being able to replace predictability or change it to excitement and adventure. In other words, how about we substitute I've got a safe job that goes on forever. I'm a school teacher. I can never get fired. Into the excitement and the adventure of, we're going to jump in the van and we're going to drive around and we don't even know where we're going. When you can find the adventure in it, that's where the key is. Think about the inevitability of things developing, things getting better. I remember we lost 3 key clients when the Howard government got in. We'd spent a couple of years getting ourselves a bunch of corporate clients in the government field. The Howard government turned up and sacked everybody, and we lost about 30 grand's worth of turnover per month overnight. I remember saying to Mary, this is the biggest disaster we've ever encountered, because it was highly profitable work, and pretty much we were set. We were on a gravy train. And Mary spent a time wandering around saying, this is great, this is great. And I said, what do you mean? She said, something great must be about to happen, because in the seeds of every disaster, in the ashes of every disaster are the seeds of greatness. Something great must be about to happen to us. I said, it better be bloody great, and it better be bloody quick, and it better turn up now. And she said, it will, don't worry, blah, 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 blah. She was thinking about the inevitability of things coming good, and I was trapped in the moment of loss. It's critically important we get away from that. Expect that you're going to be propelled in quantum leaps by technology. That is not really going to matter too much about your opinion about it. You know, you might be able to lock things in place and keep things pretty ordinary, but technology is going to change everything. You know, I said to Julie said, I hope, you know, we were filming some stuff, and she said, I hope we, you know, if we get a good take, we'll never have to film it again. I said, honey, I'm pretty sure we're going to have to film it again. I'm pretty sure that some dude's going to invent some kind of technology, which means I can hologram into your lounge room, and then we're going to have to refilm everything because we want it in the hologram form instead of the film form, and the film form is just proof that you're an old dinosaur. He goes, oh, God, you know, whatever. But essentially, we need to expect the unexpected. If we don't expect the unexpected is going to take us out. Therefore, let yourself find a new normal. You know, I talk about we went digital 3 or 4 years ago. It is now our new normal. So it's not different for us to be, or unusual for us to be talking to you in this kind of manner, because, you know, we've been adjusting for a while. So master the skills of that. I've had to learn how to talk to a screen instead of talk to a crowd of people. I found it enormously difficult, but I also realized if I didn't master those skills, I'm just going to become a dinosaur. And, you know, it's fine for me to say, oh, I prefer to talk to people. But, you know, practically speaking, that means that our business would be a dead duck if it wasn't for Zoom and Skype and our adaptability with that. At the same time, there are going to be people who don't pick it up as fast as you, and your skills in that field need to be upgraded all the time. You need to constantly be supporting people who are struggling, that come behind you. Expect a significant amount of your time to be lost in teaching others. And then finally, understand we're going into a place that we can't imagine. The future is beyond our capacity to imagine. Therefore, the only guidance you're going to have about how you make your decisions is not what's around you, but what's within you. That's why your values are the most important possession that you have. They'll become your compass for making your decisions. Having said all of that, those are basically the skills for change. I'm going to suggest to you that it's pretty true for most of us that a year ago we couldn't have pictured our life the way that it is now, despite the fact that there are some parts of it that have fundamentally not changed at all. You know, Gary's going surfing every morning. The only bit that's a change about that is every morning. Been surfing for as long as I've known him. So some things are fundamentally not going to change. Isolation hasn't really changed how I live my life in terms of the contact I have or the way that I want to conduct myself. A lot of people are saying that. But who would have imagined that we'd all be in our own houses having a meeting where we were, instead of being physically together? Okay, so that's that. That's our second session covered, pretty much. We're 8 minutes over time, but that means that we have 8 minutes less for lunch. So we're going to go to lunch now and pretty much, I've gone one page too far. You should be able, can you see the schedule there? Somebody nod? Yep, you can see the schedule. So let's get off to lunch, and we're going to be back starting in at 12:30, which by my estimation is 21 minutes from now. Ready, set, go.